Lemoine Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. President Trump has been acquitted by the U.S. Senate in his impeachment trial. He had been charged on two counts: abuse of power for pressuring Ukraine to help his reelection campaign by withholding financial aid, and obstruction of Congress for blocking testimony and refusing to provide documents after a House subpoena. The aftermath, reaction, and what happens next is all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. We're going to jump right into what's been a big day in Washington, D.C. Just minutes ago, a majority in the Senate voted to acquit President Trump on two impeachment charges. Here's Chief Justice Roberts.
The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, President of the United States, upon two articles of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present not having found him guilty of the charges contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charges in said articles.
That vote brings this impeachment, the third in our nation's history, to a close. And for his part, President Trump tweeted out just a few minutes ago a fake cover of Time magazine with some campaign signs, stuff that you would put on your lawn. It says Trump 2024, then Trump 2028, Trump 2032, and so on and so forth. He has done this before, but this happened just a few minutes ago. So we're going to hear what's next from two people: Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College, and Stan Goldman, Professor of Law at Loyola Law School. Jack and Stan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks
for having us.
All right, the vote just wrapped up a few minutes ago. The results were more or less as expected. Jack, what are your takeaways from what we saw and heard today?
Almost entirely partisan, with the extremely important exception of Mitt Romney. And going to be a lot of discussion of Mitt Romney's vote. And I'm sure that he is shot to the top of Trump's enemies list.
Yeah, first senator in U.S. history to vote to convict a president of the same party at an impeachment trial. So Mitt Romney definitely with a historic vote. And that was on the first article. On the second, he voted to acquit. But still significant in and of its own right. Stan, for hours before the vote, Senator Mitt Romney spoke that he would vote to convict the president. Let's hear a clip of that first.
The grave question the Constitution tasks senators to answer is whether the president committed an act so extreme and egregious that it rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Yes, he did. The president asked a foreign government to investigate his political rival. The president withheld vital military funds from that government to press it to do so. The president delayed funds for an American ally at war with Russian invaders. The president's purpose was personal and political. Accordingly, the president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust.
Stan Goldman, what do you make of Mitt Romney's argument?
Well, we forget that Mitt Romney took a lot of heat when he ran for president and was asked who the biggest enemy, biggest danger of the United States was, and he said Russia. And he was belittled by the opposition, by the President Obama, by the press. So it might have been actually difficult for him to look himself in the eye in the morning in the mirror and not realize that what he had heard was evidence of a president basically doing something that he thought probably benefited what he feels is America's biggest enemy. And a lot of people say he has little to lose because he's in a kind of a safe state, and he based his decision on the fact he'd taken an oath. And I think his Utah is not exactly the most pro Trump red state, but also he's due to probably take a lot of just day-to-day heat from the president, not to mention potentially even from the majority leader.
But couldn't you argue that he could afford to vote this way, considering he just got this term, and as you mentioned, all the different things about Utah and the fact that he has mentioned this in the past?
Yes, I would. I think he is in a strong position, but I don't know if it was unlike several other senators who could probably taken a vote for impeachment and continuing their, you know, in stride. Lamar Alexander is 79 and not running for re-election. He has little to prove in life. He has little to gain. And yet it was Romney who decided to do it. And once again, he has family issues. He has a niece who's high in the Republican Party. He may take a lot of day-to-day grief from the president, and the president's children apparently are already attacking him.
Jack, Romney talked a lot about how history remembers people. He said it was his oath before God that made him vote this way. And it stands to just say it again how he voted. On the first article, he voted to convict, making him the first U.S. senator in history to vote on convicting a president of the same party at an impeachment trial. So wondering, when you think about motivated and otherwise rank and file Republican like Romney, what do you think would motivate him to take a stand like this? Because conscious, as Jack, as Stan mentioned, is one part of it as well. But what other motivation could there be?
I think that's about it. This morning I was talking to my class and I said about 99% of the time you can explain what members of Congress do by re-election or the quest for power. And that's about it. This is one of that 1%. That's something else. And if you watch the whole Romney statement in video, he got very emotional, which Romney almost never does in public. And he also gave an interview to McKay Coppins of Atlantic, where he talked at some length about his religious faith and how that played into this. So I think this is one of those extremely rare cases in American politics where, as Stan said, he's going to pay a very substantial price for this. And he did it because it's what he believed in.
Because, Jack, the only thing I was thinking is if Donald Trump wins again in 2020, in 2024, if Romney wanted to present an alternative Republican for the GOP, maybe he could point to this as justification.
Oh, sure. And there are lots of other things he could do. If Romney wants anything from the federal government next couple of years, forget it. And if he wants something from his colleagues, they're going to be pretty resentful because a lot of Republicans in the Senate probably think he makes them look bad.
Talking to Stan Goldman, professor of law at Loyola Law School, Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Stan, looking at all the Republicans who voted for acquittal, do you think we saw them cast a purely political vote, or was there room to doubt the facts presented by Democrats at all?
Well, it depends on, I mean, some Republicans said, of course, they basically believed what the Democrats right. were arguing, but on the other hand, didn't think it was enough. And from my perspective,
and that was Lamar Alexander's argument,
yes,
the whole time.
Lamar
yeah.
Alexander's argument, in some respects, also repeated by other senators, once Lamar Alexander said it, I think that is the most dangerous interpretation of what's just happened. I mean, Alan Dershowitz's argument that you can't really be impeached for doing something that the president believes will benefit the country. That's an argument I think not only not supported by other constitutional scholars. I've got to honestly believe Alan Dershowitz doesn't believe that himself for a second. It is just, you know, Alan's career as a criminal defense lawyer, and he makes arguments on behalf of his clients that he doesn't believe. He did the same thing, I'm convinced, in the O.J. Simpson case. Before O.J. Simpson, before he joined the team, he was speaking about how O.J. Simpson was obviously guilty, and as soon as he joined the team, he's making other arguments. That's what he did here. And I don't believe he believes it. The problem is, it's there in the record to be used by others in the future as a basis to justify and give license to presidential conduct that we otherwise would find impeachable.
Jack, one big victory for the president and Republicans was the move to a call no witnesses, no new witnesses in the Senate. Would the outcome, you think, had been any different in your mind if witnesses were called, or would the only change really have been maybe to public opinion on this?
I think it would have been just a matter of public opinion. As Stan pointed out, some senators were already acknowledging the factual case of the Democrats, that Trump did everything he's accused of. They just didn't think it was an impeachable offense. And if Bolton had testified, if there'd been more documents, we'd have heard more of that argument. Ultimately, the Republicans were afraid of Trump. They were afraid of their primary electorates. That's really what drove this vote. And I don't think witness testimony would have made much difference to them.
Sam, one thing I noticed at the end there, after Senator Schumer was wrapping up his closing statement, Justice Roberts kind of jumped in a little bit, and to me sounded like he wanted to make a point that, and this is his, I'm paraphrasing what he said here, that he had ill-defined responsibilities in an unfamiliar setting. Why do you think, well, first off, what does he mean, and why do you think it seemed like he made a point to say that at the end?
Well, people have been wondering since the beginning, I included, as to whether Roberts would, out of character, decide to interpose himself in this, which constitutionally he might clearly be allowed to do because it's so nebulous as to what the Chief Justice's responsibility is in running this. I do have to wonder, by the way, I mean, Roberts is not merely the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He is the swing vote. The way Roberts goes, for the most part, for the foreseeable future, the court will go. And you do have to wonder if, having sat through this experience and watched what, you know, as Romney suggested today, might not have been the correct judgment and license to the executive branch, whether Roberts, who's always favored a powerful executive branch, may be in a position to reconsider some of his decisions as the swing vote on the court, if any of these issues or any other such issues reach the court.
Jack, one last thing. President Trump has a 94% approval rating among Republicans. Is it possible he's entering this election in a stronger position than he was back in 2016? Now, with everything said and done.
He has the advantages of incumbency, which he didn't have in 2016. He does have a United Party behind him. But for all of that, he is still well below 50% in approval. So especially given the state of the economy, his conduct of the presidency has been a real liability to him. And that doesn't seem likely to change during the next year.
Jack Pitney is a Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. And Stan Goldman is a professor of law at Loyola Law School. Jack, Stan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, now to the other big political story of the moment, the fallout from the Iowa caucus. Now, typically during this process, a frontrunner emerges, giving the rest of the country an idea of who just might make it to the presidential ticket. Well, not so this year, because due to a technical malfunction, we still don't have all the results. But what we do know leaves us kind of where we started, with no clear favorite at the moment. Now, of the Democratic candidates, Pete Buttigieg has a slight lead. He's followed closely by Bernie Sanders, then Elizabeth Warren in third place. Joe Biden remains a relatively distant fourth place. Now, with rather muddled results out of Iowa, a lot of attention is being paid to the California primary on March 3rd. Could the voters of this state be key deciders in who gets the Democratic nomination? Well, to assess the power of California, we turn now to Christina Bellantoni, director of the Media Center at the USC Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism. She just returned from Iowa, where she was observing with some of her students. Christina, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, you saw all of this unfold firsthand. How would you describe the political landscape right now coming out of Iowa? One word, if you could make it just one.
Muddled.
Good.
It's obviously overused, but it's pretty accurate because we just don't know. And what we saw the Iowa Democratic Party release yesterday did not make it any clearer. It's nice to have some results, but without knowing where they were collected or having the full picture, like, it is really unfair and impossible to draw any real conclusions from what happened.
Joe Biden's staff, they were pushing for no results until the full results are ready. Is there a case now for that going forward?
You know, I don't think that's fair, right? I mean, eventually you have to name all of the results. And, you know, some of what happened Monday night was a media creation. You know, everybody's sitting in studio ready to start analyzing data and all these results, and they didn't come and they had to fill dead airtime, and that irritated everybody. And so that becomes part of the story, frankly. But then in addition to that, you know, the Biden campaign, in many caucuses that the group of students observed, and then some of my sources in Iowa observed, you know, Biden wasn't you know, either third or not viable, meaning he didn't have 15% of the room in a lot of those places. And some of the campaigns I've spoken with believe, you know, he came in fourth, potentially even fifth place in Iowa. So his campaign actually is at an advantage by kind of not having to deal with that result in the moment, because we're every day that these results are delayed, that gets us closer to the New Hampshire primary, where he is likely to perform better.
And that is the next big event, to New Hampshire next Tuesday, then Nevada and South Carolina, then us, California, several other states on March 3rd. Christina, generally speaking, how much more weight does the muddled outcome, as you call it, in Iowa give the Super Tuesday states?
Sure. Well, I think it calls into question Mayor Michael Bloomberg, right? We know that he has put his focus on these Super Tuesday states mostly by spending a lot of money to get on television. He's put a lot of effort into opening campaign offices, hiring staff. He's gone to some of these early states, and that gives him, you know, the name recognition and really the states to himself as the other candidates are fighting it out in these earlier battlegrounds. So I'm really going to be watching to see what he's able to do. You know, will he win a primary? I don't know. And the country has not seen him on a debate stage yet. And that's something that, you know, will be changing. And I think is a good thing that it's changing. So that's one thing that I'm looking at. The question was, you know, how influential would California be anyway? And it's a big question. You know, 1 in 10 Americans is Californian. You've got 20 million voters. That's a whole lot of people that can have a lot of influence on this process if everybody shows up.
There's been a lot of excitement, though, Christine, about California's position this year as opposed to other years. So what would be your number one question to that?
You know, can California prove that we deserve to be early? Right. You know, for all of the flaws with Iowa's both its system and its demographics not reflecting the country, the people in Iowa, 3 million of them, you know, many of them take this very, very seriously. And they put the candidates through the paces, and the candidates spend a year there answering multiple questions. They're really forced to confront the issues that are happening in the heartland of America. And I think that that's really important. And if California demanded the same of the candidates, they wouldn't be able to just come here and raise money or just come here and spend money to get on television. They would really have to do more of that retail politics. Yes, it's difficult because California is a very large state, but it is not impossible. You know, I'd love to see a bus tour of California. No one does that. And they don't do it because the voters don't demand that they do it. So that's something that we could change. It's still, we've got 27 days to go. It's not impossible that we'll see that. But being on Super Tuesday, we know that there are many other states that are out there. And so these candidates are going to have to split their time, you know, both between us, the largest delegate prize, and some of those other states, which, you know, have substantial delegates to award as well.
Talking to USC journalism professor Christina Bellantoni. When it comes to California, though, can there really be an excuse for low turnout in California anymore? I mean, it's been almost 20 years of no-fault absentee voting, nearly 10 years of online voter registration. I mean, how much more pro-voter can California possibly be?
Exactly. And that's why, you know, everybody should be very prepared for a long time for those results to get counted. And the reasons that the California results take so long to count is because we have such a friendly, open system. You can mail that absentee ballot on election day. As long as it arrives by Friday and it's postmarked by election day, they will count it. That's a big deal. We have these experimental vote centers happening starting now. That's going to be a huge deal. I, for example, will not have to get up early and vote in my neighborhood before I come into work. I can vote right here on USC's campus at the vote center. That's a huge time saver. And I think it does really encourage participation. So I would love to see, I mean, you know, my husband's Australian and they have compulsory voting. And I would love to see something like that because I just think it's the most critical thing that we all do. And the more people's voices are heard, the more likely the politicians will do things that people want to see done.
You know, you mentioned Michael Bloomberg earlier. He pretty much has just set up camp in California for a while. You mentioned all the people he has hired, all the staff he has hired. Any sense if that's going to give him traction or if this is a good approach or the right approach for him?
You know, look, voters do like attention. And, you know, he's had the state to himself, both, you know, in television airwaves. You've got Bloomberg and Tom Steyer and a couple Bernie Sanders ads. And that's it. And, you know, it's nice that he's coming in and, you know, getting to know voters. But it's not a ton of attention, right? He's had two appearances here, a couple on other parts of the state. And I think that a lot of people are are kind of waiting to see what he actually has to offer as a candidate, because we don't know. All you know about him is what you're seeing on his television ads, or maybe what you knew going into this election, which is not a ton for the majority of voters.
Yeah, but even you mentioned how California can sometimes double as an ATM for national Democratic names, and Bloomberg is flipping the script a little bit on that, considering the cash he carries. I mean, that's got to be a little bit different for voters to see a candidate not ask for cash.
Yeah, you know, look, and that's something like Elizabeth Warren talks a lot about, too. She's like, I'm not going to be out doing, you know, big fundraisers in L.A. like everybody else. Sanders has largely avoided that. They don't have the same kind of mega donor fundraisers that the others do. You know, Vice President Biden is going to actually leave from the debate in Nevada and come back to L.A. and raise money and then go back to Nevada to campaign for those caucuses. So, you know, sure. But look, like, money makes the world go round, and particularly with our laws right now, there's effectively unlimited money that can be spent on elections. And when that happens, unlimited money will be spent on elections. And I think no matter who's in the race, whether it's a billionaire or somebody that only takes $5 donations, you're going to see more money raised and spent than ever before, because people understand that the stakes are very high. You know, referencing back your last segment on impeachment, there's this moment in this country people are really feeling high tension, whether they support the president or don't support the president. There's a real intensity of feeling right now. And I think that that's going to continue to play out in these Democratic contests. And I don't know that we're going to have a clear front runner until at least after Super Tuesday, and maybe not even then.
That's USC journalism professor Christina Bellantoni. Thank you very much.
Have a good one.
All right, a couple of California communities have been engaged in a lawsuit with fossil fuel companies. We're going to find out all about what's going on, because all of this is happening right down the street from us here in Pasadena. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, now to a moment many have been waiting for. Civil rights leader Bayard Rustin, whose life was turned upside down by a criminal conviction in 1953, was pardoned posthumously by Governor Gavin Newsom. Rustin worked alongside Martin Luther King Jr. He helped organize the 1963 March on Washington and the Montgomery bus boycott. But his legacy was always tainted for an arrest in Pasadena more than 60 years ago for having sex with men in a parked car. As a result, Rustin spent 50 days in jail and had to register as a sex offender. The morals charge used as the basis for Rustin's prosecution was one of the many discriminatory laws used to target LGBTQ folks at the time. Assemblymember Shirley Weber, along with Senator Scott Wiener, advocated for Rustin's pardon. Here is her reaction to the news.
Thank God, you know, we have a governor who recognizes that some of these things could be politically motivated or be very unfair, and they have the courage to say, hey, we need to correct the errors of the past.
Newsom's announcement is part of a new clemency initiative intended to pardon others who have been prosecuted in California for being gay. With us to discuss the initiative and its impact is Katie Tinto, clinical professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Clinic at UC Irvine School of Law. Katie, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, can you explain for us what's outlined in the initiative and what it'll do?
Yes. So Governor Newsom wants to use his pardon power, which is his executive power as the governor, to pardon those who have misdemeanor convictions or convictions on their criminal record that were based on conduct that we now realize was discriminatory and unjust, basically that they were criminally convicted for having consensual adult sex between two gay men. He's trying to recognize that the law was unjust, that those prosecutions and convictions were unjust, and offer them kind of a streamlined process to obtain a pardon.
So who does this apply to? Because it sounds like it might be narrow.
You know, it's hard for me to know offhand how many, if we're talking hundreds or thousands of people. Mm-hmm. My guess is probably more hundreds, but I could be wrong. But it is narrow in that it is the streamline process that he's announcing is looking for folks who have convictions based on these discriminatory laws that we that are no longer on the books, but that these convictions remained on these people's individual records.
What were some of the impacts of old discriminatory laws, like the one Bayard Rustin was convicted under?
Well, certainly, as you mentioned, many of these men faced jail time, did days in jail, and 50 days in jail is no small amount. Being a registered sex offender is horrible and puts a lot of limits on your daily life. Now, we already had previously allowed folks to get off the sex offender registry. That was, I believe, in 1997. But having a misdemeanor conviction on your record may impact employment, your ability to obtain a professional license. So there are a lot, besides the fact that it's as a stain, that it's possibly humiliating having a conviction for something that we now all acknowledge is part of our rights and our ability to have consensual sex with adults that we realize that we all have today.
It's amazing, Katie, right? I mean, that in 2020 that someone would have this on their record going back decades. It just seems like it's not real.
I think it's a significant move of Governor Newsom to say, we are going to use our executive power to pardon, kind of our highest acknowledgement that something was unjust, and we're going to make sure we use that pardon power to this group of people. I think that's significant.
Now, when it comes to initiative like this one, is it in line with the direction that California's legal system has been moving in?
Yeah, so pardons, as you can imagine, are actually also used much more broadly, and we've seen Governor Brown and hopefully now Governor Newsom expand their use of when they grant pardons, because a pardon is the governor's ability to say, you've been rehabilitated. Now, that's not true in the Rustin context, right? But if in the broader context of someone who has committed a criminal act and has a conviction, it's a recognition that they've been rehabilitated and they shouldn't be harmed by this conviction for the rest of their lives. So, just last year, the legislature passed the Pardon and Commutation Reform Act of 2018, which helps, which is reforming some of the pardon process, speeding it up, getting more transparency to it. And I think it's also part of a broader push by the legislature to say, we want to recognize that not all of our criminal laws in the past were fair, were just, and we also want to be able to have people who do have convictions to be able to move on from those and not be burdened by their convictions for the rest of their adult life.
And just as a quick FYI, how does clemency differ from an expungement?
So an expungement is a process we have through our criminal state courts, which allows people to, people might say erase it, but it actually just kind of hides it for employment purposes. It allows people to apply for jobs and not mention that they have a criminal record if they've gotten a criminal conviction expunged. But a pardon is really kind of the highest honor we have, again, because it's issued by our governor, to recognize that someone's taking kind of extraordinary steps to rehabilitate themselves.
So then I can already hear why this move by Newsom is an important one. It sounds like it definitely has more weight.
Yes, this one has more weight in particular because not only is it saying I want these people to not have the burden of a criminal conviction, it's actually recognizing that the very prosecution for these acts was unjust and discriminatory. So it has this additional layer of kind of recognizing our own mistakes in the criminal justice system that I think is has long time been coming for this population.
Katie Tinto, clinical professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Clinic at UC Irvine School of Law. Katie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. Two California communities, Oakland and San Francisco, have been engaged in a lawsuit with several fossil fuel companies the cities say have contributed to climate change by selling their products here. Now, today in Pasadena, a panel of appellate court judges heard arguments about where this battle should be carried out, in the state courts or the federal courts. And here to tell us all about it is KPCC's Sharon McNary. Sharon, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right, so what's this lawsuit really about?
Well, it's a really novel strategy. City attorneys can sue companies for creating a public nuisance and force them to stop it and pay for the damage that they caused. It's been done before. Local governments went after the makers of lead paint and got a settlement of hundreds of millions of dollars to remediate the problem. So that's what they've done here. They're trying to do this with fossil fuels and get the oil companies to cover the costs that the cities are going to face.
I remember that lead paint case. People were getting under the paint in their houses and realizing what was there for a long, long time. All right, so this is a nuisance case. In what way? And what are those cities arguing exactly?
Well, in this case, the city attorneys of Oakland and for the city and county of San Francisco are saying that Chevron and four other big oil companies created this public nuisance by producing, marketing, and selling oil and gas that we now know is part of what's causing climate change. They argue that their cities are going to have to cope with the effects of climate change, like the bad air quality, sea level rise, increased risk of fire, and that can mean billions of dollars of future costs on their taxpayers.
And the cities believe that all of this should be hashed out in state court.
Right. And that's because they're suing under a state law that allows cities to go to court to stop a public nuisance. Now, the principle of the law is very old. It's like to keep someone from dumping trash in the middle of the street or making horrible noises at night. But this new application takes a very hard look at the causes of climate change and saying the oil companies have to address the damage that it'll do.
Now, the oil companies are led by Chevron. How have they responded to this?
The oil companies say global warming and climate change is something that goes way beyond city or state boundaries, even international borders. So that's one of the reasons they want this argued in federal court. One of the oil company attorneys was saying you could have Alaska and Texas treating oil companies very differently from a place like California. And they say a more uniform policy should apply. And then they further argue that this should not be a nuisance case because those cities were built on fossil fuels. They wouldn't be major American cities without energy to run factories or oil and gas to fuel everybody's vehicles. It's a little bit like the legal fights over tobacco where people were getting sick with cancer and the tobacco companies were saying, well, you know, they had research about it causing cancer, but didn't say so.
Yeah, I remember that as well. So, okay, so what's at stake here?
Well, manufacturers are watching this case very closely because anyone who makes anything that could harm the environment could be held liable if the cities win in this case. I spoke with a guy from the National Manufacturers Association, Phil Goldberg. He says cases like this make scapegoats of the energy industry, even though we all use the energy and the fossil fuels. We all drove the cars and we all painted our houses with lead paint. He says we should just admit our collective fault and move on.
That's exactly right. This is something where we all have to come together and have common sense solutions, innovation, political leadership to drive us to where we need to get to, not lawsuits.
So the manufacturers who represent industries far broader than oil and gas, they don't want to see that precedent set if this case goes forward and lets all kinds of companies be held to account for the effects of climate change. So they want the case dismissed and have a clean slate and move forward with better regulations.
So when can we expect a ruling on this?
Appellate judges will typically release a ruling later this year.
All right, that's KPCC's Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, coming up in just a few minutes when Take Two continues, it is Oscar week. The Oscars are this weekend. And we remember 4 years ago, there was the Oscar So White controversy. We're going to find out if exactly the Academy has done much to change that, to see if that hashtag will ever be used again. Plus, Oprah Winfrey rarely makes any kind of moves that get any criticism, but there have been two in the last few months. We'll get into all that when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, a historic day in U.S. history, and Nick Roman, host of All Things Considered, is going to be all over it. Hello, Nick.
Hello, Abe. We'll look at what happens next now that the Senate has acquitted Donald Trump in his impeachment trial. We'll also look at the app that triggered the Iowa caucus debacle. They still haven't counted everybody yet.
Not yet, yeah.
Some in Santa Ana are fighting plans to build a homeless shelter there. They say Santa Ana bears the burden of Orange County's homelessness crisis, while wealthier cities do little to nothing. Adolfo Guzman Lopez will have a closer look at that. And two more jetliners from China have arrived in California with Americans on board. They'll be checked for coronavirus. Test results will come from the CDC labs in Atlanta. But now, regional public health labs are going to handle some of those tests. And we're going to look at that as well. It's all on All Things Considered at 4, right after Marketplace at 3 and The Frame at 3:30.
All right, that's Nick Roman. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, we're going to take a break from talking about Iowa and the primaries and talk about a different voting story, and that's the Oscars. Plus, it's been a very vegan award season, and you have Joaquin Phoenix to thank for that. Let's go on the lot.
Hey, shut up! God, I wish you'd
stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She speaks with us every Wednesday to guide us through all things showbiz. It's been a while, Rebecca, but welcome back.
It has. Iowa Schmiowa. Let's get to the Oscars.
Iowa Schmiowa. All right. 4 years ago, the Oscars so white controversy forced the Academy into bringing more diverse members into the fold. Rebecca, you did a deep data dive into the Academy's membership then and now. So first, give us a sense of what the numbers were like before the inclusivity push.
Well, in 2015, the year before the Academy began its inclusion drive, the group's membership was 92% white and 75% male.
92% white, 75% white. Okay, rough place to start. So over the last 4 years, how have the diversifying efforts reshaped the makeup of the Academy?
Well, the Academy pledged to double the number of women and double the number of people of color in its membership. And they have met that goal for people of color, and they will meet that goal for women when they invite this year's class of members. One thing the Academy initially announced that it was going to do as part of this push was move some members to an emeritus status. That would be people who had not worked in the industry for a long time. They've stepped away from doing that. There were some criticisms that it was ageist when they proposed that at the time.
All right, so let's talk about the new numbers. And the Academy grew a dramatic 35% during its inclusion drive. Where do the stats stand now in terms of age, women, and people of color?
Well, the group is now 84% white and 68% male, so that's a significant change from when they started this drive. Age, the Academy itself doesn't disclose. In 2012, the LA Times analysis, which I worked on, found the median age of a voter was 62. Here at The Hollywood Reporter, we did our own analysis of the age of the new members who've been invited since the inclusion drive, and their median age was 50. So you can make the assumption that the median age of the membership is coming down.
There's no way, Rebecca, the Academy could report on the age of actors. I mean, they would not like that one bit.
Well, they just have to check their IMDb. Most of them are on there.
Most of them maybe lie, too.
Because right,
true. Some of those don't match up. All right,
those now, are not birth certificate certified. That's
no.
True.
Now, all those efforts, and yet of the 20 acting nominations this year, only one went to an actor of color. So it's clear the Academy is trying, but it isn't really reflecting in the nomination so far.
Well, I mean, this is a question the Academy is grappling with because they have done a significant amount to try and address the sort of whiteness and maleness of the group. I think they have a ways to go, they would acknowledge, but they are grappling with why that has not been reflected in the nominations. Sometimes people point to pipeline issues. This year, there seem to be a lot of films that would have given them opportunities for nominations. One thing the Academy says they're doing is they're going to be having some conversations in the spring about what exactly excellence means. How do you evaluate what quality is? These are conversations among their members.
Now, as you point out in your article, Rebecca, that despite the Academy's very aggressive efforts, it's never going to really able to truly be representative of the U.S. population. Why not?
Well, that's if they keep inviting people at the rates that they've done for the last 4 years, which are, again, much more inclusive than they have been in their more than 90-year history. But there's a small problem here, A, and that's math, basic math. Because over the course of this diversity drive, the Academy has been inviting 46% women. The U.S. population is 50.5% women. So the Academy will keep getting closer and closer to 46% women, but they'll never surpass it and therefore never have parity if they keep at this current rate. They've been inviting 31% people of color in the new classes. The U.S. population is 39% people of color. So again, much better than when they had what they had been doing, much more inclusive, but not enough to be reflective of the wider population.
All right, now to another story that's been grabbing some headlines. And it's a really a rare thing for Oprah Winfrey to have anyone question her judgment on projects, but nowadays everyone is fair game. She got a lot of blowback for picking the novel American Dirt for her book club and also was questioned for dropping a documentary that she was an executive producer for. Rebecca, what was that film about?
Right. This is a movie called On the Record, which just premiered at Sundance. It's a film about sexual assault victims who are accusing Def Jam music mogul Russell Simmons. It was made by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, who are Oscar-nominated directors who've made multiple movies on the subject of sexual assault. It was kind of seen as it was going to be the Me Too movie of the music business.
All right. So what was the production process like for this film and also the working relationship with Oprah and the directors?
Well, it seems like it started out very positive. Apparently, in the beginning, Oprah was quite supportive of the film. And at one point, there was going to be actually a series that she and the filmmakers were doing together with Apple. But at some point in December, after it was announced the movie was going to Sundance, Oprah began to have concerns over what she described to the New York Times as inconsistencies in one of the accuser's stories. She also, according to this New York Times story, sent the film to Ava DuVernay, who had some critiques about it as well.
Now, I can't imagine, Rebecca, that someone with as much clout as Oprah Winfrey, that she would buck to anyone's pressure. But was anyone trying to apply pressure on her involvement in this documentary?
People certainly were, and clearly, I mean, Oprah interviewed the Leaving Neverland accusers, the accusers of Michael Jackson, and there was an enormous amount of pressure on her for doing that. So she has stood up in the face of pressure in the past. She has said that Russell Simmons did try to influence her in this case, but that he had no impact on her decision. There were also people like 50 Cent campaigning via social media to get her away from this project.
All right, so this film, On the Record, has had a very tortured start. What's going to happen with it now?
Well, it just got acquired by HBO Max, so it's that streaming service's first ever festival acquisition. It got a standing ovation at Sundance. It's 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, so it seems like it is going to survive this departure of Oprah.
All right, Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the business of entertainment. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, I'll bet that when the Kansas City Chiefs beat the San Francisco 49ers in the Super Bowl this past Sunday, that you probably thought, okay, good, the football season is finally over. Maybe I can think about basketball, baseball season's right around the corner. No. You would be wrong, because after a nearly 20-year absence, a brand new old professional football league is back. And L.A. has a team of their own. And I'll pretend I'm the mascot so you can guess their name. That was really bad. We'll tell you all about it coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, back in the winter of 2016, Los Angeles was a pro football free zone. It had been that way for more than 20 years after the Raiders and the Rams left town in the 90s. Then the Rams came back in 2017, followed by the Chargers, and suddenly LA went back to being a two-team football town again. Well, we're about to find out if three's a crowd, because on Saturday, another football team will be in the mix, one with a brief L.A. past as part of a league born to be controversial. Here to tell us all about it is LAist Mike Rowe. Hey, Mike.
Thanks so much.
All right. It is a return of the Extreme Football League, the XFL. And while back in 2001, its lone season of existence, LA's team was called the Extreme, this new rebooted version is called the Wildcats. So before we get to them, let's hop into the Take-Two time machine, go back a little bit. Tell us about the XFL's first go-around 20 years ago.
Well, it was the brainchild of WWE Pro Wrestling's Vince McMahon. It was a partnership between the WWE and NBC that ran for one season. It was trying to be loud, trying to be extreme. You had X in the name. You had X in the team names. You know, the LA actually got, we won the only season of this this league. We won the championships thanks to the LA Extreme. Their quarterback was Tommy Maddox, a former UCLA Bruins star who actually went on to go play in the Super Bowl with the Steelers and bring it home for them.
Yeah, I remember Tommy Maddox. Yeah. He was a big star at UCLA. Right. Yeah, and as I mentioned, the XFL lasted only one season. Mike, what were some of the reasons for its short shelf life?
You know, I think a lot of fans weren't ready for this extreme attitude. You know, a lot of NFL fans like the NFL. They weren't trying to find something that was trying to be the opposite of it. One of the big controversies was there was a game that ended up delayed because of a power outage, and then it went into double overtime, and it pushed back that night's Saturday Night Live by 45 minutes.
Ooh.
It made NBC executives mad. It made Lorne Michaels at Saturday Night Live mad, and there were so many controversies like this. The cheerleaders were marketed in a very sexist fashion.
Oh,
they did
yeah,
a whole
yeah.
thing where they sent like camera crews into the cheerleaders' locker rooms.
I remember that.
It was just a big disaster. Contrasting visions between the pro wrestling guys and the NBC. And ultimately, the ratings took a dive because it wasn't what fans were looking for.
All right, so what will be different then with this new version of the XFL?
You know, Vince McMahon's actually taking a backseat this time. He doesn't have the big pro wrestling attitude. It's going to be run. It's actually the league's commissioner is Oliver Luck, who's sort of a respected, sober sports executive. You know, they did some very dangerous rules the first time to try to make things more exciting, including like an opening scramble that led to some shoulder separations.
Yeah, what they would do is they would put the football in the middle of the field. You know how they do the coin toss to see who gets the ball first? Well, that's not what they did. They put a football in the middle of the field and had everyone run to it. Whoever grabbed it first, that's who got the ball first.
And not a good idea.
Yeah, imagine just a bunch of big, giant guys crashing into each other to grab a football. Yeah, some injuries resulted.
You know, this time it's sharing a network with the NFL. NBC actually had an ad during the Super Bowl for the XFL. It's sort of a continuation, a little aperitif, just giving you a little bit more football, but some very subtle rule changes to make things a little bit quicker, but it's not that loud, brash thing it once was.
And Oliver Luck, you mentioned he, the person running the league, he's the father of a former great NFL superstar, Andrew Luck, who played at Stanford and also played for the Colts for all those years. All right, so some of the rules of the new XFL have changed since its past incarnation. We mentioned one of them that's designed to make football a little bit safer. What about some of the other rules in terms of playing?
One of the biggest ones is that there's a shorter play clock. A lot of folks are wondering whether they're actually going to be able to make the plays happen that fast, but they've added an extra official on the field to try to speed things up. They've been experimenting with having more microphones in all the players' helmets. Just
oh,
so
really?
They
all of them? Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So that they can get to the scrimmage line, get there, and not have to be scrambling around and call plays on the fly. It's going to be really interesting. I think one of the other really interesting things is they're changing the point conversions. There's no extra points. It's going to be, you can choose between a 1, 2, or 3 point
or
conversion.
Three, wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
You just sort of, how far back from the end zone you go. And it's going to be really interesting to see how teams use this and really make the game more interesting and a little bit faster, hopefully.
And one of the things, Mike, that I've heard about is two forward passes on a single play. So in the NFL, you throw a pass and then that's it. The guy catches it and he runs and then it's over until he gets tackled. But this time, the guy that catches it can actually throw it further down the field. So that should be pretty interesting.
Yeah, they actually are doing it. So it's designed to allow there to be more trick plays and not have to have any problems that usually go on that. The experts sort of designing this, they expect this to be used maybe once or so per weekend of gameplay because it actually has to be still behind where the play starts. So you can do a pass, but only within that area.
You know what, Mike? I'll bet the NFL is kind of looking at some of this to see if they can borrow it for the NFL at some point.
I think very likely. Yeah. You know, the original XFL actually had some of the presentation ideas taken by the NFL. You know, those aerial cams over the field?
Yeah.
That came from the XFL originally.
We're talking to Mike Rowe. He writes about art and entertainment for LAist.com. NFL.com. All right, Mike, so tell us about LA's team, the Wildcats.
You know, they're going to be playing in the Chargers Stadium. They are having their opener this Saturday in Houston against the Houston Roughnecks, and then their home opener the following
week. I love these names.
Right? They have the Dallas Renegades is going to be their home opening the week after. It's a little less extreme than the original. They had a team called the Hitmen in the original XFL.
So yikes!
It's not quite as violent this time around. You know, the LA team, you know, they're trying to connect with the community. They had a big block party. Tickets are also very cheap. You know, I believe I saw tickets around $25 each to get into a game.
That's not bad, yeah.
Yeah, so it's trying to do something a little bit different. They're trying to show that they have a connection with LA as well. You know, Norm Chow is their offensive coordinator. He ran the USC Trojans offense in the Pete Carroll days. So that could mean some exciting, fast-moving plays. Also, the team president was formerly with the LA Football Club soccer team and also came out of UCLA.
And their colors, they're black, red, and light orange. I've seen them. It's not a bad combination.
I mean, can go for this.
Yeah. It has the helmet has an L and an A, not quite interlocked, but kind of sort of. Yeah, it kind of has a nice little feel to it. All right. Now, so it sounds like it's all pretty well outfitted, but really, Mike, bringing back the XFL to Los Angeles. What's the wisdom here for all this?
You know, I think that they are trying to see if there's an appetite for spring football. There was another league that tried launching last year. It folded after one season. This time around, they're hoping that they're able to keep things going by being connected with the NFL. They have also a lot of money behind them. You know, Vince McMahon has agreed to give at least $500 million is what he's ready to commit to keep this league going. He's already taken sold stock worth hundreds of millions of dollars in order to help finance this. For the first 3 years, they are not getting any fees from the network to be able to keep the show going. But after a few years, they're expecting to be able to get big rights deals that will help pay and be able to make this investment pay off in the long run.
Now, looking at the roster of the LA Wildcats, and I looked at some of the other teams in the XFL, they have some young players with NFL experience, so I'll probably give them a bit of a peek here and there. Mike, you're LA's arts and entertainment guy. What do you think of their chances of sticking around for more than just one season?
You know, I think that it seems like they have the money, they have the time. It's going to probably go at least a couple seasons. I think the big question is whether they get those rights deals in a few years that they're hoping to, because if they don't, then this probably won't be financially beneficial in the long run.
Mike Rowe writes about arts and entertainment for LAist.com. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, eh?
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, just go look for us wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be. You can also find us on social media at Take Two on Twitter. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.